Hi, I'm John Harwood, your host for Bedeviled, a podcast about American democracy from the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. We bring you conversations with politicians, journalists, and academics about preserving the delicate balance of our fractious system of self-government. Before Donald Trump became president the first time, Daniel Ziblatt warned about the possibility he might pull the United States toward an authoritarian-style government. Ziblatt and his co-author, Stephen Levitsky, both Harvard professors, described the dangers in their book, How Democracies Die. 3 months into Trump's second administration, their warnings appear prescient. Trump has turned the machinery of government against his critics. He's stretched executive powers granted by the Constitution beyond recognition in deporting immigrants and terminating federal programs authorized by Congress. He's punished news organizations, law firms, and universities that won't do his bidding. He's even suggested he'll ignore adverse court rulings. I spoke with Ziblatt about how these developments compare to other countries that have drifted away from democracy and whether they represent temporary departures or permanent changes to the American system we've known for more than two centuries. Professor Daniel Ziblatt, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
You became very well known, of course, for your co-authorship of the book, How Democracies Die. Give us a status check of the health of American democracy at this moment.
Well, we wrote that book back in 2017, 2018, and it was really written as a warning about what could happen looking at other countries around the world. We made some predictions at the end of the book, a good case scenario, worst case scenario, middle case scenario. And I just was recently looking at it, and in many ways, the worst case scenario looks very similar to what we describe, what is actually happening. I mean, what we described was a situation where this was in the first year of the Trump presidency that we wrote this, that Trump has control of the presidency. Republicans have all control of all branches of government, as well as the Supreme Court. And in fact, that's where we are. And so, you know, things have happened much more quickly than I ever expected. And so, you know, that's what we're living with today.
Is that the biggest surprise? You know, I was looking at an op-ed you wrote in The New York Times at the end of 2016, probably as you were writing your book.
Yeah.
And you said the democracy is not in imminent danger, but the warning signs are real. You talked about the shattering of norms, the encouragement of violence, the questioning of election results. Has anything about this surprised you since then?
I would say that the speed, with the second term, the speed of what we've been witnessing over the last several months, the relative ease with which, you know, the so-called power ministries, that is, you know, the Justice Department, the Department of Defense, the highest ranks of the military, have been kind of occupied in effect by the forces, the MAGA forces. You know, I kind of imagined a bigger struggle. That's not what we've seen. So I think the pace is one thing. And I think related to that very much, I mean, sort of stepping back, the longer term process, the degree to which the Republican Party has gone along with this entirely. I mean, I think we expected when writing that book back then that there would be more kind of pushback, more, you know, internal fighting. And that's, you know, that's not at all happened.
Well, a lot of us thought that the fever would break after January 6th, the post-2020 election period, because it was violent, it was live, it was on television. Why do you think that didn't?
Yeah, I think it could have. You know, this is one of the other things, you know, as a political scientist and a social scientist in general, we spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, are things structurally predetermined? You know, is the kind of nature of our institutions, the nature of our economy mean that humans don't really make much of a difference? Leadership doesn't make much of a difference. There's another view, which is that, you know, there's critical moments in history where leaders can make a difference. And I think actually things could have gone another way. And in particular, what I think about is, you know, in that period, January 2021, immediately after January 6th, when former President Trump at that point was really isolated in Florida. The Republican leader, you know, even Kevin McCarthy didn't want to talk to him at first. There was an opportunity, I think, at that moment, you know, had the 14th, you know, this thing that they did tried to do with the 14th Amendment to disqualify candidate Trump, had that been deployed right at that moment, for instance, or had the conviction of the impeachment gone through, there would have been very little, few people would have come to his defense and history would have been written in another way. But because that moment was passed, then the effort to kind of retroactively, you know, several years later, once the campaign had almost already begun to try to disqualify Trump, became unacceptable. And you know, at the point at which the 14th Amendment, where people were talking about using the 14th Amendment to disqualify Trump, you know, at that point, I was very ambivalent about it and sort of thought it wasn't a great idea. Had it happened earlier, though, so it's all, you know, as in life, you know, politics is all about timing. Had it happened earlier, I think there would have been a moment where we would have moved past this. And it's not just hypothetical. I mean, we can look at what happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro, who organized his own, and you know, the kind of Trump of the tropics, as the New York Times once called him, who organized his own attack on the Congress and courts and so on. The Brazilian political system rallied to isolate him and exclude him from politics. And, you know, and Bill has moved on from that moment in a way that we haven't.
Do you think that had inflation not been so politically damaging and Trump had lost a close election in 2024 rather than winning one, would that have been a pivot point, or would a close election, whoever won, signal that this danger, the threat, would continue for a long time?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I do remember right up in before the election, some people saying, I don't know what is worse, a really close election that Republicans challenge or a victory by Trump. And I sort of thought at the time that that was silly. I still think that's silly. I mean, I think it would, by whatever means, you know, democratic means necessary to keep somebody autocratic out of power is the way to go. But no, so I mean, the thing is that in a democracy, the only tool we have, and it's totally frustrating tool and an imperfect tool, is elections. I mean, that's the great power of democracy, is that you can get rid of a bad leader peacefully. And so, you know, you mentioned the fever breaking, you know, the idea that the only way a fever will break in a democracy is through elections, through losing. Somebody loses, their agenda is discredited because they've lost. You know, you go home and you think about what you've done wrong as a party, and you come back with a new product on offer. And so that's the only tool we have at our disposal. And so in 2024, had Trump lost again, You know, I don't know if that would have been enough if it had been a close election, but that's the only tool we really have. And so that would have been the best option on offer, I would say.
You've made the comparison to Hungary and the sort of slip sliding away from democracy under Orban. This first 3 months of the Trump presidency, second presidency, have gone at a frenetic pace. Has the United States moved faster toward authoritarianism, say, than Hungary did?
Yeah, it is analogous. I mean, I'll tell you one similarity. I mean, I've spoken to some people who were in the Hungarian opposition at the time in the parliament. And, you know, and what they describe in those early years when, so Orban had been in power in the late 90s, so similar in a way, came back in 2010 with a very clear agenda. But I think the difference was at that point, the Hungarian opposition didn't quite understand what a threat Orban was. You know, I think, you know, there's some sense of Democrats maybe didn't as well, but I think there were all the signs were there, I think, for us. But what happened in 2010 in Hungary was they passed lots of legislation through a unicameral parliament and would, you know, give bills to the opposition on a Friday night and say on Monday we're voting on it, you know, massive 1,000-page bill about all sorts of topics, and hidden on page 400 would be a small paragraph about reforming the courts or something. And so the opposition wouldn't even have time to read this stuff and didn't even know what they were voting on. So you know, so that was happening very quickly. But I think, so my sense though is that the fight took much longer in Hungary. I mean, the effort to kind of remake the judiciary, which was one of the major things that Orban did, happened more slowly. I mean, what's happened here with the Project 2025 is really, you know, much more of a thought out plan, and this effort to kind of capture again the Justice Department, the firing of inspector generals, the kind of takeover of the Justice Department, the Defense Department, the FBI. I mean, and in some ways that, you know, the president has this incredible power because of our constitutional structure, and they pushed it to the limits. And so, and the only way I can make sense of it really is to think of this not as like month three, but it was rather year five of a Trump presidency. And when you think about it in those terms, then you realize you know, any authoritarian 5 years in, 6 years in is able to kind of recede this quickly. So I think that's the only way to make sense of the pace by which this has happened.
Trump's done a lot of things in that 3 months. Gutted the FBI and the Justice Department to pursue enemies. He's tried to cripple the capacity of government through cutting spending programs, even though that's the domain of Congress under our Constitution. He's reached out to punish law firms and the press and universities. Is all of this, does all of this fall under the rubric of the rule of law?
A lot of it does. You know, so there's things that are direct assaults, I think, on democracy and civil liberties. So, you know, this the deporting of people out of the United States and incarcerating, more than deporting, incarcerating people outside of the United States without any reference to a kind of legal process and do, you know, and basic rights under the 14th Amendment are a direct assault on civil liberties. Now, of course, there's this issue, you know, maybe they're not citizens or whatever, but as you know, has been said by lots of others, in the 14th Amendment refers to the rights of persons, not citizens. And plus, we don't know if the rights of citizens are being violated because there is no process. So presuming that citizens have been not only deported, but incarcerated, you know, this is a direct assault on a core, one of the core pillars of democracy, which are civil liberties. So that's very obvious. But there's other ways as well, you know, so one might think, well, you know, let's say the closing of USAID, is that really an assault on democracy? Or is this just bad governance? You know, I have a colleague, a political scientist who's written a book, Jeff Kopstein and Stephen Hansen, called The Assault on the State, in which they argue there's a global phenomenon. There's an attack on state institutions, and it's different than an attack on democracy. And in some ways, that's what we're witnessing. But I think there is a these do represent assaults on democracy implied in your question, because there's a circumventing of the constitutional process, because there's a way in which, of course, the Congress has the power of the purse, and there's, you know, not much legislation is passed currently through the House and the Senate, I mean, if any at all. And in fact, policy is being done in effect through executive order entirely, which, you know, this executive orders have been abused by all presidents, I would say. But the degree to which it is happening in domains that are really under the direction of Congress represent a fundamental assault on constraints on an executive, which is a second major pillar of democracy. I guess one final thing, which, you know, we've only begun to see some discussion of, is the kind of third pillar of democracy, which is the right to political participation. And there's these kind of discussions now of kind of trying to provide some federal oversight over elections, or, you know, using DOGE to kind of infiltrate into the electoral process. That hasn't happened yet, but that is something that I also would recognize as identify as a major threat to democracy. But in general, this, you know, it's, you know, we have to always remember that there's this difference between, you know, one can be democratically elected, you know, as Trump was, legitimately democratically elected. But that doesn't mean that once in office, everything you do is democratic. And I think that's the sort of basic law and people's understanding of this often, is that if you, you know, and that this using of the referees of the state, the neutral actors who are supposed to be defenders of the rule of law to go after your enemies and protect your allies is represents an assault on, it represents a threat to democracy in the following way, because what it does, it gradually leads to an uneven playing field, where it makes it harder for people to be critical of the government. The costs of being in the opposition raise. Like, if any individual critic, academic, journalist, law firm, university, the cost of defying, criticizing the president become exorbitantly high.
Do you have any worry personally that the administration might target you because of what you've written?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had that experience, but directly. I mean, I haven't been, you know, it's super vocal and so on. But I think it is, it's a concern. It's in the back of anybody's mind who speaks publicly, that, well, you know, I have to be careful about what I say. And so, you know, we try not to overreact to that. But there's a cost. I mean, that's why we see people, you know, depending on one's position, you know, I think being a tenured professor at a university is a pretty secure position, but, you know, if you define democracy as, essentially being able to be in the opposition and to be critical of a government, if the price of that increases to a certain level, then essentially your democracy is facing a serious risk. And I think that's where we are.
Now, the judiciary at the district court level has pushed back to some degree on things that Trump has done. Do you have any confidence that that the judiciary or all the way up to the Supreme Court will check the president's use of power?
Not a lot of confidence. I mean, I guess what I see is a kind of, you know, it's a, I mean, best case scenario, I sort of think, you know, best case scenario, like 2/3 of stuff gets blocked. 1/3 of stuff goes through that's atrocious. And not only is it represents a problem for democracy, but undermines basic governance capacity. And that's a best case scenario. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, courts are critical, important. And, you know, there's a lot of federal judges who are taking important stances. But, you know, we need more than that. I mean, we need an electoral process. We need civic leaders to step up. And we need all of these kinds of institutions that are sources of resilience in a democracy. So the courts are very important, but that's certainly not going to be, one can't just sort of say, okay, well, they'll take care of it and I can kind of focus on my own thing. I mean, I think the courts need to be supplemented with other actors.
Let me ask you about the role of international relations in this. One of the other things that Trump has done is effectively align the United States with other authoritarian governments, Russia most conspicuously. Is that a self-perpetuating thing that once a leader moves in that direction sort of reconfigures who the allies are, who the good guys and the bad guys are, does that keep going and deepen the issue?
Well, I think it's certainly revealing of, you know, we back in 2017, 18, we had this litmus test, like you kind of recognize somebody who's not committed to democracy by a set of behaviors. We didn't include on that list, but we might have. Who you choose as your allies. I mean, what company do you keep in effect? And so that's certainly an indicator of something. You know, I think that it's not clear that, you know, being allied with Hungary really, like, it's not clear how that, let's say, increases the robust resilience of Trump's rule in the United States. I mean, a lot of these allies are actually, internationally speaking, pretty weak. But it reveals who he thinks his allies are. And I think the broader point, though, is that what it does is it may isolate us from our traditional democratic allies. And I think that is bad news. And we see this with the battle over the tariffs and so on, that, you know, the kind of increased isolation of the United States and the degree to which, let's say, people, you know, we've seen huge drop-offs in the number of tourists coming to the United States. I think students from abroad will increasingly feel like they don't want to come to the United States, scholars, researchers. This increased isolation means that less information and effect is coming into the United States, and it weakens the U.S. So, yeah, this isolation is bad news.
Well, let me ask you about the tariffs. One of the things you wrote last fall was that there are multiple ways that a society can resist the push to authoritarianism, but that there's one that the United States hadn't effectively tried, and that was civil society rising up and pushing back. With the tariffs, we have seen huge immediate financial costs and had some pushback from not only ordinary citizens who are watching their 401ks be damaged, but also business leaders and some of the what we think of as establishment Republicans. Does that tell you that there is some prospect of broad pushback from civil society?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, that it is about an economic issue, not about these other abuses on democracy. You know, and in some ways, you may say this, you know, the stock market is like kind of the final guardrail protecting a democracy, potentially, you know, which, you know, I'm not sure what I think about that. But it is true that there has been this pushback on this policy. And, you know, one can't separate. I mean, on the one hand, you know, one isn't seeing that same kind of pushback in other domains. So that's discouraging. On the other hand, you know, we live in a world in which, you know, your political strength is determined by, you know, your last policy success or failure. And so, I mean, to me, it's an open question whether this whole experience that we've just witnessed in the last, you know, 12 hours, last 5 hours or whatever, today with the reversal is, you know, is a sign of weakening that may diminish his ability to kind of bully people and so on. I don't know. I'm not sure. But that's possible.
One of the things you wrote in 2019, as Trump's first term was nearing an end, was that he had been enabled by a philosophy within the Republican Party driven by fear that preceded the election of Donald Trump. You said they had adopted a by any means necessary ethic toward holding power. Does that tell you that after Donald Trump passes from the scene, this will continue to be the operating style of the Republican Party?
Yeah, it's hard to unlearn the lessons of when once one learns that what one can get away with, it's hard to unlearn that. You know, a lot of things that people thought were unacceptable and would result in major electoral punishment by voters haven't generated that kind of punishment. And so then you sort of say, well, actually, we can do this and get away with it. So that's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle, in a sense. You know, and there's voters now who sort of say, okay, this is fine. This is what we want. And, you know, there's, tens of millions of Americans who voted for this. And so there'll be other politicians out there who will say there are these voters out there who I can tap into who will sort of try to replicate the same formula. So that's not very encouraging. But on the other hand, again, I guess I would say that, you know, major electoral defeats, you know, if people have said this before, you know, you need major series of devastating electoral defeats. And, you know, when I say that, sometimes people say, well, that's so naive, that's so unrealistic. But the problem is that they're really in a democracy, there's no other alternative. That's the only blunt tool that we have.
Well, speaking of that, and my last question is about, let's say the Republican, Donald Trump finishes his term, Democrats take power with an entirely different approach to governance. How much of the damage that the United States has suffered over the first 3 months of this year to the rule of law, to civil liberties, a whole range of things that you've talked about. How much of that's recoverable, fixable?
Yeah, you know, I think this is sort of the most concerning thing to me. And I would add to that less bureaucratic capacity as well of government, because
scientific research, all that.
Scientific research, all of these things are long run outputs of a kind of long historical process. You know, take scientific research. You know, you can't, you know, you stop a study, you stop a generation of young scholars who will go elsewhere to do their research. It'll take a generation to rebuild this stuff. I guess that's the thing that I'm most concerned about. It's not like turning off the light and turning the light back on. I mean, it's easier to destroy a democracy than to build a democracy. And so I do think it is possible to build it, but it's going to take a generation of work.
Are there examples that you've looked at of societies where that had operated under the rule of law, seen it in effect discarded, thrown to the side, recovering the rule of law?
Yes. I mean, there are cases like this. I mean, one can think of, I mean, usually the loss has to be devastating enough that people learn from it. I mean, like one immediate example is, let's say, Chile, you know, a longstanding democracy until the mid-1970s when Pinochet came to power. And then, you know, by the end of the 1980s, after a period of really bad rule, leaders got together and realized the stakes had been high. They had lost so much, and there was an effort to rebuild democracy. And, you know, and democracy today is pretty stable. You know, you can think of, I mean, these are very dramatic cases. Franco's Spain was many, many decades, of course, of authoritarian rule. And then, you know, there was a kind of gathering of, I mean, and the way this happens, I think, is that those former opponents, you know, who kind of realize what was lost and come together often, you know, interestingly, like in the case of Chile, it was leaders sort of had to remove, it was, you know, the stories that I've heard about this is, you know, members of the center right and the center left were all in the United States, you know, University of North Carolina, I think it was, and sort of got together and discussed things and kind of began, they were on like on sabbatical, or people, you know, people got together out of the kind of heat of the political moment and were able to kind of begin to find common ground. And so, you know, I don't know, you know, how exactly that would happen, but that's, I think that's really the only formula. You know, we sometimes think, you know, the period of course, you know, German fascism, we think this kind of thing that we can't compare the US to. And I think, of course, you know, it is very different. But one of the things we sort of forget is that the Nazis were only in power for 12 years. I mean, this is, you know, and think of all of the damage that happened. But that 12 years required, you know, a generation to reconstruct what happened. But it was only after 12 years of damage, you know, obviously murderous dictatorship, which is something that I don't think we'll be experiencing in the United States. But, you know, it can, a few years of authoritarian rule can do a lot of damage, and it takes a long time to build oneself out of it again.
Well, a note of possibility to close with, perhaps a long-term possibility. Professor Daniel Ziblatt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Thanks for listening to Bedeviled. This podcast is possible because of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. It's produced by Maria Luisa Fresson-Nori. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to Bedeviled on all podcast platforms.